This week, the U.S. is accusing Sudan's Rapid Support Forces and its allies of genocide. Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, leader of the Sudanese Armed Forces, and Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, head of the RSF, are fighting for territorial control. Displacing people, inflicting violence on women and children, creating the world's largest humanitarian catastrophe. What will it take to stop the Sudan war? Straight Talk Africa starts right now.
Welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from our headquarters in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Peter Clote. This is the second time in 20 years that the Darfur region of Sudan is experiencing a brutal conflict inflicted by the same generals for the same reasons. Over 11 million Sudanese have been displaced. Thousands have died. Women and girls are victims of violence, and millions of people are hungry. On January 7th, the United States determined that genocide is being committed by Sudan's Rapid Support Forces and its allies. VOA reporter Henry Wilkins has more.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a January 7th statement that Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, and allied militias have systemically murdered men and boys, even infants, on an ethnic basis. Determining that crimes committed by RSF and its allies amount to genocide. The leaders of a Darfuri advocacy group reacted to the news.
The community in Darfur is well aware of the crimes and violations committed against them. They consider these acts of genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity to be a natural part of their lives. For them, the recognition and acknowledgement by the international community and larger countries is a victory and a step towards achieving justice.
The RSF and its associated militias are mostly ethnic Arabs, victimizing black Sudanese, particularly the ethnic Masalit people. The declaration is a first step towards justice, say rights groups.
They can feel that their trauma is recognized. I mean, I don't want to understate that.
Blinken also announced sanctions against RSF's leader and businesses linked to the paramilitary group. Windishim says this is the second time in 20 years that genocide has been declared in Darfur.
Lessons unlearned and not enough preventative action.
Many consider genocide to be the most serious crime under international law.
It's significant from a legal perspective, but I think also from a moral perspective.
Blinken singled out RSF commander Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for violating commitments under international law to protect Sudanese civilians. One leader accused in the 2004 genocide in Darfur is still on trial at the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, Rojal says ethnic killings continue and that ongoing fighting in parts of Darfur has led to famine.
Direct killing inside the camps, in the cities and neighborhoods, and starvation, famine, and hunger, these all continue.
When asked for a response to the accusations, an RSF spokesperson provided VOA with a statement widely shared on social media. It said, "This decision has no value or impact on the current situation in Sudan, but may complicate the Sudanese crisis." The statement does not deny the allegation of genocide. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
That was Henry Wilkins reporting. For more insight into this complex situation, I'm joined by Danica Damplu, Policy Manager at the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington, D.C. From Kitchener, Canada, I'm joined by Brian Adeba, Senior Policy Advisor at the Centre for Sudan and South Sudan. And from Paris, we are joined by Jean-Baptiste Galopin, a senior researcher for Crisis, Conflict and Arms of Human Rights Watch. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Straight Talk Africa.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so let me come to you, Danica, first. The U.S. has designated Sudan genocide. What does this mean, and how do you see this playing on the ground?
Thank you so much again for having me on this panel. To begin with, I think we should recognize that this determination is also a recognition of a failure by the international community to prevent the genocide that we're seeing in Darfur. As Nicole Wittersheim of Human Rights Watch mentioned, this is the second time in a few decades that this determination has been made. In terms of, we also should recognize that this determination is being made as mass atrocities are ongoing. So in terms of events on the ground, we continue to see genocidal violence in Darfur, as well as the risk of mass atrocities and ongoing mass atrocities throughout Sudan. So this determination is not a somber recognition of crimes that have been completely finished. It is a warning also about crimes that are underway. It's also important to recognize that for this determination, it will not automatically lead. It is a tool, not something that will automatically change a situation which the international community has failed to prevent from evolving into its current context.
Brian, what is your take?
Well, I think this determination should kickstart some processes. One, the international resources available to immediately take measures to protect the people whose lives are in danger right now. We're talking of no-fly zones. We're talking of troops to protect civilians. I mean, a genocide is happening. So international processes to protect civilians must kick in immediately. Secondly, I think there is need now for the international mechanisms to kick in to start to hold those behind the violence accountable for the violence that they've committed, for the atrocities. Thirdly, I think the determination should also now cajole the international community to pursue a peace process to end this conflict and end the suffering in Darfur.
Jean-Baptiste, let me come to you. Recently, you were in Sudan. You visited a few places as part of your research. What is the latest development on the ground? What did you witness while you were there?
Thank you for having me. Since the conflict started, we've been doing a lot of work documenting abuses by the warring parties, working with a number of methods, both remotely but also in refugee camps in Chad and South Sudan, as well as most recently within Sudan, where we managed to travel to South Kordofan, part of the country that has witnessed RSF attacks against communities who were mainly from the Nuba ethnic group. And you know, what we found there was widespread attacks against the populations, including killings, destruction of homes, systematic looting and burning of homes, and also rape and sexual violence, including a case my colleague documented of this woman who was detained alongside 49 other women on an RSF base and gang raped every day by RSF fighters. Now, these abuses are really emblematic of the atrocities that we're continuing to see in Sudan and really mirror what we found in other places, including West Darfur, where, you know, we found that the RSF had carried out ethnic cleansing and against the Masalit population of the capital city of El Geneina, and that these crimes amounted to crimes against humanity and widespread war crimes. So we're very, very alarmed by the continued atrocities that are being carried out in Sudan. Just this past few days, we've seen horrific images coming out of Al Jazeera state, where communities had been occupied by the RSF and were already bearing the brunt of atrocities. And now we're seeing atrocities being carried out by forces loyal to the Sudanese military after they reconquered areas of around Wad Madani. So it's an extremely dire situation at the moment.
Mm. Let me come to you, Danica. What do you think the next step should be after the U.S. designation, pretty much saying genocide is occurring in Sudan?
Absolutely. So first off, it's important to remember that the finding of a genocide determination by a U.S. Secretary of State does not in and of itself add new legal obligations to the U.S. government. What it can do is increase the amount of political pressure on the U.S. government that could make it easier for the government to actually deploy different tools that could be useful in this context. So very quickly, some of the tools that could be deployed that the determination can support through political pressure are more targeted sanctions, ideally with efforts to put pressure on the backers of the perpetrators so they can't shield them from the impact of the sanctions. This determination should prompt a reevaluation by the U.S. and ideally other governments of their strategies for Sudan to make sure that they focus on civilian protection. This determination should help add political pressure for the U.S. to continue to support the International Criminal Court's investigation of Darfur, as well as U.S. funding for documentation initiatives on the ground to help secure and pursue accountability for the crimes that are taking place in Darfur. And lastly, and to echo Brian Adeba's point, we need to see the hope is that this determination can actually help to mobilize the kind of international attention that atrocities of this scale really should warrant, and a greater investment by donors in humanitarian support and by the international community in political pressure on the perpetrators and their backers to end this conflict.
Brian, talking about the international community, critics say that it appears the war in Sudan has been neglected by the international community. So much focus is not placed on what is happening, the catastrophic situation we are seeing right now, the displacement of people all over the place, the death, among other issues that have been experienced. What is your take? Is the international community doing enough?
Not nearly as enough as not nearly as enough as is warranted for the kind of atrocities that are happening. I mean, like, Sudan is just a small cog in the wheel. There are other conflicts that are tied to geopolitical interests that take priority at this particular moment. But that should not be an excuse, given now that we have this genocide determination, given the evidence that's coming out about atrocities being committed by both sides in the war. I think the next step is also to look into how the genocide determination itself can be expanded as the war continues, expanded to include other actors that were previously not mentioned in it, as we see now the recapture of the central state of Jazeera in Sudan. We see that the Sudan Armed Forces is committing the same types of crimes that the RSF is committing. So there is a need to actually revisit the determination in the near future or very soon when the next administration takes over to explore whether there is a means or a modality to include other actors and list them as perpetrators as well.
Jean-Baptiste, before we go on a short break, there are discussions and recommendations that an imposition of a total arms embargo could help jumpstart the process to ease or try to resolve the conflict. Your take?
I think the international community, and particularly the U.S. and to a lesser extent European countries, have thrown all their weight behind efforts to mediate between the warring parties with a view to obtain a ceasefire. And in doing so, they've neglected other tracks, other policy options that would alleviate civilian suffering in Sudan. And meanwhile, these efforts for mediation have not borne fruit, and the hopes of a ceasefire appear to be constantly receding, with the Sudanese military on the advance and sending very strong hardline signals that they will not negotiate a peace agreement. Meanwhile, civilians continue to be targeted across the country. Nowhere is safe for civilians in Sudan, and famine is raging and expanding across Sudan. So we're calling on a number of actions on other fronts. One is, as you mentioned, an expansion of the existing arms embargo currently in place on the Darfur region to the whole of Sudan. We think it's a no-brainer given the scale of the conflict that has hit Sudan since 2023. The second track would be urgently creating an international mission to protect civilians in Sudan. We think it should be deployed in areas where civilians are most at risk. And, you know, there were some kind of budding efforts in that direction from the African Union Peace and Security Council and from the UN Security Council in May and June last year. But unfortunately, the international community has pretty much dropped the ball since then. The UN Secretary General has offered option for protections of civilians, which did not even consider the creation of such a mission, which was extremely disappointing to us. And so we you know, the conflict is not going anywhere. We're seeing every month new communities being affected, new armed groups, new militias entering the conflict. And so it's really urgent that civilians be protected now.
We'll get back to you soon. It's time for a short break. When we return, we'll continue our discussion on the Sudan conflict. Stay with us.
In times of change, when the world seems uncertain, and what we hear doesn't reflect what we see, we seek the truth. When we are told only part of the story, we lose trust. In moments of crisis, our dreams, hopes, and wishes for a better tomorrow depend on a free press. At Voice of America, we bring you the stories that people take risks to see. We connect the world and unite it with truth. At Voice of America, we show you the whole picture.
Health, wellness, sport, beauty, medical breakthroughs. Healthy Living cares about your well-being. What are the main health concerns in Africa and around the world? Find out the latest on coronavirus. Connect with our experts and ask them questions.
How long does the virus stay?
Join me, Lino Khmudu, in Washington, every week on Healthy Living, right here on VOA.
Home is where your style shines. The Afrohemian style is redefining how we express culture through decor by blending vibrant African heritage with the relaxed and eclectic vibes of modern design. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we'll explore how Afro-modern design offers fresh take on home decor, and we'll share tips on how to achieve this Afro-chic style on any budget. Join the conversation each week right here on Our Voices.
Welcome back. You are with Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from VOA headquarters in Washington, D.C. We are discussing how the Sudan conflict can be resolved. My guests are Danica Damplu, policy manager at the Simon Scott Center for the Prevention of Genocide of the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum here in Washington, D.C. Brian Adeba, senior policy advisor at the Centre for Sudan in South Sudan. And Jean-Baptiste Galopin, senior researcher for Crisis, Conflict and Arms Division at Human Rights Watch. Welcome back again. Let me come to you, Danica. Talk to me about humanitarian access, because these warring parties have been accused of restricting humanitarian access to unarmed civilians who have been negatively impacted by this ongoing conflict. What say you?
So I think there is abundant indicators and documentation that both parties are using, as the United Nations put it, food as a weapon, that they are arguably, both sides are using control over aid as a military strategy. So the Sudanese armed forces have, through their through Port Sudan, allowed access to more aid, most notably through the Adrei Pass into North Darfur, where famine has been declared. But humanitarian aid workers have spoken of myriad complexities and bureaucracies that are actually inhibiting their ability to deliver aid. And at the same time, the rapid support forces, who control much of Darfur, have also been documented as restricting access to aid, in particular during their siege of the city of El Fasher in North Darfur. So what is clear is, while these two different groups are using aid and aid access in different ways, both of them see aid as political, and both of them are using aid access to food to accomplish other objectives. So in order to obtain humanitarian access, it will be really critical to see this as essential to civilian protection critical and see civilian protection as essential to the delivery of aid. You cannot have one without the other, particularly as aid continues to also be seized by criminal elements and other groups that are able to access it while it takes the long roads to reach the civilians at risk.
Brian, there are discussions that political pressure or the international community should put pressure on the warring parties to ensure the protection of civilians during this conflict. Where do you stand on it?
I think I stand on the position that we need immediate help to protect civilians. It's easier said than done, but the international community should take all the efforts that are available right now at the Security Council. And I urge the Security Council to put aside their differences and authorize some sort of force to protect civilians in Sudan. We cannot watch this happening again. We've watched it happen in 2004. It's a blight on our conscience. And all measures at this particular moment should be taken to protect civilians. But not only protecting civilians, I think at the core of this is the issue of finding a political solution to this conflict. And even as this genocide determination is made, there's need to expand the sanctions regime in Sudan, targeted sanctions against perpetrators of violence. And there's need for the international community to play their part in holding those who have been sanctioned accountable. But also importantly, sanctions should also just not be just issued like that without a strategy. Sanctions should be tied to a coherent political strategy that resolves this conflict. And unless that is done, we will see the violence continuing. And importantly also, sanctions should target the whole set of players in the sanctions matrix. Here we're talking about the perpetrators and the enablers. And unless this is done, I think the chances remain slim for peace. It's time to wake up.
Jean-Baptiste, what are some of the other recommendations being put forward by the Human Rights Watch to resolving this conflict or finding a solution to it?
So as a human rights organization, our recommendations focus on how to protect civilians, you know, whether the conflict continues or ends. And on that front, we put the framework of international humanitarian law, the laws of war, at the core of our analysis and our recommendations. And I would like to come back to this question of the famine and the obstructions on aid. I mean, this is presented as a humanitarian crisis, which it is. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in the world right now. And when you speak to humanitarians, many will tell you that the scale of the famine in Sudan now could be worse than what we saw in the 1980s and 1990s in the Horn. But it's also a matter of international humanitarian law. Deliberately denying humanitarian access is a war crime. Starving people is a war crime. And we would like diplomats to really start focusing on this issue as a matter of international humanitarian law, which means there needs to be accountability for the officials who are responsible for the denial of humanitarian access. There needs to be sanctions against these people. And when you see the position of the Sudanese government, I mean, as was discussed earlier, I mean, of course, we've seen attacks on food supplies by the RSF. Denial of access by the RSF, but the Sudanese government is also, on this front, equally responsible. We are seeing the Sudanese government systematically obstruct the delivery of aid in all sorts of ways, with an effort in particular to restrict, to deny completely aid to areas controlled by the Rapid Support Forces, and to control and restrict aid deliveries in areas that it controls. And the positions taken by the Sudanese government at the UN are really, really shocking. You see a Sudanese representative of the Security Council denying that famine is even occurring. And Sudan took the decision to withdraw from the IPC, which is the international body that monitors hunger across the world, making it only harder for the IPC to do its work. So it's really urgent to to take actions against officials who are responsible for that, to ramp up the pressure against the parties for the denial of aid so that humanitarian organizations can access people who are at dire need.
Let me come to you, Danica. The UN and the African Union have been criticized for not doing enough, that the neglect is palpable, and that the UN particularly is focusing on other conflicts rather than the atrocities being committed in Sudan. Where do you stand on that? Do you think the criticisms are justified?
I think if we have determinations that there is genocide, that you have even the UN's own Human Rights Council fact-finding mission on Sudan identifying systematic atrocities, I think that's proof itself that the international community's commitments to preventing these kinds of atrocities have not actually been met. And the African Union and other regional institutions have some leverage, understand the context, and there is more that could be done to support, not just reinforce things like sanctions or to support arms embargoes from the United Nations or other systems, but to actually provide more support and pressure on some of the belligerents to cooperate with some of these, to their own commitments through the Jeddah Declaration and to abide by international humanitarian law, as has been mentioned by my colleagues. So there is a lot more that could be done, and I echo the finding of the other panelists that the Secretary General's report does not meet the demand, the request, the recommendations for civilian protection that we saw from the Sudan fact-finding mission. So I think there does need to be much more effort, much more support, and most importantly, effort and support along the lines of where each individual body can best exert its own leverage. Or countries like the United States don't have the same leverage, and nor do they understand the context as well as an institution like the African Union. So it would be good to see those institutions play a stronger role in preventing and halting mass atrocities.
All right. Let me come to you, Brian, briefly. Where do the people of Sudan go from here, looking at the situation currently?
I think the people of Sudan at the moment are yearning for peace, and they're looking for it seriously. The wins by the Sudanese armed forces in Al Jazeera or Central State right now do not signal that there's going to be an outright victory. The only way to resolve this issue is through peace negotiations at the table somewhere in the neighboring countries.
Briefly, before we go, Jean-Baptiste, what is the way forward?
As I mentioned, we need the urgent priority should be the creation of protection of the civilian missions. And, you know, I mentioned how the UN Secretary General has dropped the ball on this. But I think the African Union also has a huge responsibility right now. In May last year, the Peace and Security Council commissioned the high-level panel of the AU to look at options for atrocity prevention, and since then there's been nothing. So it's really time they step up and take action to protect civilians.
Thank you very much. We have to leave it here. Thank you all for the thought-provoking discussion. Danica Damplo, Brian Adeba, and Jean-Baptiste Galopin, we appreciate your time. Thanks to our affiliate stations for broadcasting Straight Talk Africa across the continent. I'll see you next week. Bye for now.